We're all lined up, and I'm looking at this dog. And if you handle dogs, you know anything about dogs, there's two ways of a dog's growling. One is, the other is, you don't want to hear. It's a signal that you're not just dealing with a dog. As I would find out, you're dealing with a dog that knows how to do serious damage. He's got that instinct. He's got that wolf instinct. And I'm standing at attention, and I have to tell you, I can remember every excretion that my body was putting out at that moment. I was terrified because that dog, that's what he was doing. And as our sergeant came down, and by that time I'd already been through what they call combat defense training. I was in security police. I had learned to react what the sergeant said you do. Do you understand? That would follow me right through the Justice Department, working for DEA in South America and Southeast Asia. That training, they love guys who come out of the military who follow orders, whose first loyalty is to the bureaucracy, whose first loyalty is not to you guys. Do you understand? You gotta listen to my show. There's an interesting show that's going to be on Monday. I did with the FBI historian. And we talked about a certain kind of person who goes into an agency, a bureaucracy, a military, not really to serve, because he doesn't think much of you. He wants to be in this agency. He wants to be cloistered. He wants to be protected from you. He wants to have power over you. The wrong kind of person. Well, let's go back to me at this particular time when I was a perfect mold. I was the guy. And the sergeant is coming down, and he's bang, bang, go in. Bang, go in. Bang, go in. And what that meant is, no matter what that dog, that animal was doing, you sucked it up, and you stepped in. And I could hear dogs growling. I could hear dogs biting guys. Now you imagine, I would rather face a gun than a poodle. And I'm looking at this thing. And the sergeant taps me on the shoulder and he says, go in. And what I found out about myself was that either I was courageous enough to suck up all that fear or I was a coward. And I couldn't say no to that sergeant. You tell me what the answer is, but I did step in. And what happened was, that dog stood about right there. And he continued to growl a couple of minutes that seemed like I can still hear the echo. And then I so froze that he got bored. And he went back into his little kennel house, you know? And that's, I was empowered. Do you understand? I had this tremendous feeling of power, that a high that no drug can give you. No drug, a person, a little high that no drug can give you. Now, all these years later, one of the things that terrified me as much as facing a dog was doing this, standing up here and talking to an audience. And DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, this is during the Vietnam War, had a speakers bureau. And they wanted a volunteer to go out to Brooklyn College during the Vietnam War and tell the audience what an undercover narc does. Like they, of course, nobody volunteered. We knew that you're going out there to be a target, to be derision, to be ridiculed, to be jeered, because the battle lines were clearly drawn at that point in our history. It was us against them. Do you understand? The Constitution that you swore to uphold no longer meant shit. You are now in a bureaucracy that defended itself against you. And I was part of that. But I was also ripped by this fear. I had to face this fear. And my partner was a guy, if you read my books, you'll know. My partner was a guy named Skippy Garcia. And Skippy and I, we didn't get along. We weren't good together. We were a good undercover team. I played Mr. Big. He was the street guy. And we had informers. And that night, we had an informer. Now, here's the thing about informers. Informers set people up for us. And nobody gives a damn what the informer... The only thing that the government cared about, that Congress cared about, that the U.S. attorney cared about, were numbers. Now, the informers found out that they could put anybody in jail and get paid for it. And why put a dangerous guy in jail if I could get away with giving up a local cab driver, a local friend? Why? Why worry about it? If I can give up my cousin's boyfriend, I didn't have to worry about him. All I had to do was convince the cop that the guy was a drug dealer and then find a way to set him up. And now that happened all the time. You understand? All the time. So what it depended on is how good the agent is, how good the police officer is, how honest he is in the playing of this informant game that you're all about to become involved in. How good is he? So me and Skippy, Skippy, again, like I said, we didn't get along. We're driving out there. Before I went out there, the head of the, guys, by the way, please bear with me. We're just waiting for the VHS to get here. Before we got out there, the head of the Speakers Bureau told me, he said, you know what you do, kid? He said, you got to tell these pinkos a joke. That'll loosen them up. You know, I said, well, Ernie, what do you mean a joke? A joke. You know, you tell him, like, here's a joke I use, he said. Guy goes to the doctor. The doctor says, I got good news, I got bad news. He says, the bad news is you got Alzheimer's. The good news is next week you won't give a shit. I said, you want me to tell that to Brooklyn? You want me to tell that to Brooklyn College? I'm terrified. And Skippy, on top of this, my partner, is saying, we got informers. We got cases. We're going to be up all night. Why do you got to do this? What are you doing? You know, I don't never want to work with you. And I am working with you, and I don't never want to work with you. I said, I had to face this fear. How do you tell people about these secret inner things? Now I cut to me in front of Brooklyn College, an audience as big as this, staring, jeering at me already, antagonistic. I could feel, and maybe rightfully so, I mean, I was an undercover narc. That's pretty scary to these people, but there I was up there vulnerable. Do you understand? I'm vulnerable. I'm up there, I'm a target. You can get rid of all of this aggression right now. And they were doing it. And all I'm thinking of is joke. Joke. And I look over and there's my partner, Garcia, just shaking his head, ready to slide under the chair. And there's a murmur and jeering. And now a professor gets up and he says, we have here from the Drug Enforcement Administration, undercover agent Michael Levine. He's going to tell us what undercover agents do. Holy crap. This to me was worse than facing Silva. So I stood there for a moment and my brain frantically groped for a joke. And I said these words, exactly these words. My name is Michael Levine and I'm a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration. And before I can speak, it is a regulation of the Justice Department that everyone here has to be searched. So will you all please rise and empty out your pockets, and my partner, Emilio Garcia, will circulate. And I look over, and Garcia was under the seat. And there was a beat. And then everybody rushed for one door. And there was one guy who was jeering me more than anybody he was afraid to move. It sounded like rain. Everything was going out of pockets and people were running. And he went cataleptic. And the last words, it's a joke. It's a joke. So, and the only reason I'm telling you this story, which is not a joke, this is a true story, by the way. I don't think you could make up anything like this. I think you could make up anything in my life. But what I'm going to do tonight is try to pull these dots. I can see the VHS is here. What I'm going to do tonight, this afternoon, I hope it's valuable to you. I want to try and educate you to understand what is being done to you, why it's not in media, and what is about to happen. How bad it is, and you don't already, and why you don't know it. And if you say, yeah, you know, I'm getting nervous, that's what I want. I want you to be nervous. If you say, I don't know, do I trust this guy? He's an undercover. You know, I have to tell you, I've been on WBAI for 5 years now, and there's still people on WBAI who don't trust me. Of course, I wasn't. One guy stops me in the hallway, and you ever see cartoon characters for people stoned, you know, with X's they put over the eyes? So I'm confronted with a guy at BAI who's got like two X's. And he says, you know, people think you're a plant. I said, a plant? What kind of plant? A tomato plant? You know what I mean. You know. No, I don't know. Like, you're a plant for the government. You're going to... So, well, let me ask you something. How am I doing? Am I getting close to my mission here? So, while I can... Yeah, go ahead, buddy.
I'm just wondering, as a college story, you were an active undercover cop. Why would they have to talk to you in front of these people? They might recognize you a couple years later in an actual operation.
He said, why would they have an undercover cop going up in front who might actually, you know, be seen? One of the first messages that you've just picked up, and I congratulate you for it, is a lot of the people running this shit are as dumb as doorknobs. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question, though. You're absolutely right. You know, but, yeah. Yeah, here it is. When you guys stop it, when I give a signal, rewind it, and you're going to have to amplify the sound. I'm getting a DV. I'm getting this thing improved. I apologize for it, but we're going to try and. The sound is a little low. I'm used to an audience of maybe 40 cops at a time, you know, with a 19-inch VHS, and so I. I want to tell you something. The guy wrote a book about me. You know, first of all, crooks are not that smart. Let me tell you. There was a book written about me by a writer named Donald Goddard while I was a DEA agent. And the book is called Undercover. Don't even look for it. It's a terrible book. But on the cover of Undercover, which came out in 1987, is me standing on the cover. And I was still an active undercover agent, and DEA gave him permission to write the book. So I decided for the hell of it that instead of using my badge, I was going to try to lock a guy up with the book. So I go out in Washington Heights, and I'm undercover, and I'm buying cocaine on the street. We had informers. Now, again, we're informers. We had good informers. We had great systems to get informers. If you're targeting, and a lot of drug cases around the world overlap terrorism. So one of the things I want to tell you now, one of the reasons I went on the air is because we're beyond a point where left, right, whatever your political beliefs mean, don't mean anything anymore. We're right at the precipice. We're right at the end game now. We're at a point where your politics aren't going to mean anything. That's how dangerous this world has rapidly become. I urge you to write down the website. That you can hear all our shows for a week free of charge. If you want to join, you can download the whole archives for 4 years. It's expertwitnessradio.org. Expertwitnessradio.org. Now, the reason I say that is because there are, what I've tried to do is expertwitnessradio.org. What I've tried to do for the past 5 years is bring those few people from the inside who are willing to tell you the truth, who are willing to go to risk going against the bureaucracy and tell you the truth, and they're on the air. You can hear their voices live. And that's very, very important for you, because among the things that you will hear are where I brought 4 federal agents on with 100 years experience in CIA, FBI, DEA, all overseas. All these cases overlapped into terrorism for years. And we predicted in November 1998 the World Trade Center disaster. You can hear the voices yourself. November 1998, we predicted it. We said it was going to happen. Hear the voices yourself. Now, we had the kind of intelligence, a really good intelligence operation, and that's what I'm going to try and show you now, will get the information before it happens.
Here's the situation. We don't have any audio from the tape, and we're probably not going to have any audio from the tape. All we have is video.
No, it's okay. We'll get it hooked up. I just want to see, like, what's playing audio. Put a mic on it.
Okay.
Great. Yeah, if you put a mic on it, that'll be better yet. You know, we... Yeah. Okay. Keep talking. Yeah. Yeah, please. And I give you a signal. Just stop it. Because, you know. And you're going to see a case right away. We're going to show you a clip from it. I helped produce a piece for 60 minutes. So you're going to see, we're going to start off with the beginning of a piece for 60 minutes. That's called Informants. And we're just going to show the first part, and then after this is at the end of the presentation, I'm going to play the whole piece. It's that important for you. It's about an 11-minute piece. But what's really important about this informant piece is what I'm going to show you with the first case is a case that you, go ahead. Let's see how it says. You know, we'll get started. Little trouble. Okay. What we're going to show you is a case where. All the way back in the mid-80s, we sent informers. We ran a case. We had the informers. We knew how to work them. We ran a case from the tribal areas in Pakistan right into the John Gotti organization. Now, we had intelligence as to terrorism then. DEA. The case was killed. I'm going to explain to you how idiotic the whole thing is. But let's cut to now. Right after those planes flew into that building, into the World Trade Center, the news told all of you that you're getting the best from the U.S. government, that all these agencies are now talking and we forgot all these rivalries, blah, 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 blah. 24 hours later, I got a call from DEA agents who had worked in Afghanistan who said, we have informers. And we called the FBI, and the FBI said, we'll call you. Do you understand? And instead... These nincompoops, these inepts, this Federal Bureau of Ineptitude, instead was given the Patriot Act and rewarded with tons of money. And I had a poster I had out there before, and on the bottom of the poster, it said, you guys, if you want it, I'll pass it out before the night is over. On the bottom, I had originally put, this poster may be in violation of the Patriot Act. Beware. I thought that was a joke. But my sweet wife, Laura, said, please take it off. And you know what I thought about it? And I realized that her fear is justified. Her fear is justified. You recognize? Can you guys see that, or should we? Okay. So all we need is sound, and it looks pretty good. That's an attorney I worked for, and how are we doing, guys? All right. The first case, let me tell you about it so it'll save me time. The first case you're going to see is I am actually set. What happened is, and this is how intelligence gathering covert ops goes. It began with an informant in jail. The informant in jail calls me. He wants to work. He's serving 30 to 40 years or something like that for heroin trafficking with Pakistanis. He's an Italian. Why are you calling me? I ask him. He said, I heard about you. I heard you that I can trust you. I said, well, what can I give you? Because informers work for something. I said, I can't get you out of jail. He said, well, I want whatever money I make goes to my wife. So now, this is very important. The man knows he cannot get out of jail. Now, me, as an informant handler, I know that. And it doesn't, these guys don't care about their wives. It doesn't matter to them. But I know something is wrong, but I'm playing my cards correctly. You wait, you listen, like the KGB said, you trust and verify. This is from the book Deep Cover, by the way.
Cut down trees so that our plane can land.
Yeah, you can rewind.
Guard our drug plane.
What happens is, in the case culminates, you'll see the culmination in about a minute or two, where the John Gotti organization, we go from bank, we go...
Willie Sutton said he robbed banks because that's where the money was. If Willie was alive, he'd probably be working for the government, because that's where the money really is. Last year, various government agencies paid crooks somewhere between $40 million and infinity. We don't know how much, no one will say. It was paid to so-called criminal informants for information on drug dealers. The information has led to enormous busts and to horrifying mistakes in which innocents paid dearly. We can't give you numbers because, again, the government does not keep track of its disasters. The biggest disaster may be the war on drugs itself. Over a decade, $100 billion has been spent and more Americans are addicted than ever before. But you wouldn't believe it from watching television. Drug busts are television's meat and potato. Action guaranteed. And law enforcement, from county cops to the feds, bring us along to show one and all the taxpayers' money doing dangerous work. And most of all, they invite us in to record the results.
The biggest danger of cops are seen in 20 years.
Barely a week goes by without the record drug bust of the day, week, or century.
They need the numbers. They need the statistics. It's a business. In our country, it's a business now.
The agents are under pressure, career path pressure, to come up with bigger, more newsworthy cases.
And if they don't, somebody's in trouble.
Strange bedfellow. Eugene Iredale, a San Diego defense attorney, and Michael Levine. For 25 years, for four different agencies, America's top undercover cop. Both say the net result of the war on drugs is a bloated, corrupt bureaucracy, whose only measure of success is the big...
Stop that. Yeah, right there. All right. We're going to play this whole... It's so important that you see this whole show. After I do the presentation, I'll make it as short and concise as I can. Again, I'm not used to talking to non-cops with this undercover survival, covert ops. I want to explain to you what you saw. That was the end of a case, of a heroin trafficking case that went into the tribal areas of Pakistan. A case that began with a jailhouse informer. Now, the reason I say jailhouse informer is because this is critical to what's going on now. Are you guys all familiar with the case of the CIA agent, Johnny Mike Spann, who was killed? Johnny Mike Spann, if you saw it on CNN, was killed by Mujahideen in a Mujahideen prison camp. He went in to talk to Jeffrey Lynn Walker. Now, just think for a second, to us, to professionals, the first thing that we thought of is, if you could get an informer in that prison, he is worth more than his weight in gold. He could give you intelligence. He could have found out, possibly, if he's accepted, he's already accepted by the Mujahideen, if you could get him working for you, You have an ear into possibly finding Dr. Evil himself. Don't forget, Jeffrey Lynn Walker was busted right away at the beginning. And now we all know it's coming out that he was willing to talk. In fact, you couldn't shut the man up. Instead, you had this spectacle of two CIA agents, armed and dressed up like military little soldiers, in front of every prisoner, saying, "You want to talk?" And of course, regrettably, he was attacked, bitten. They tried to bite him to death, and killed with his own gun. Because, you see, it's elementary that when you want to use a prison informant, you don't do that. But this is Tom Clancy's CIA. Do you understand? So when I get together, and I've had professionals who teach this, I teach this to police agencies. And you say, this is what's spearheading our war on anti-terrorism, that kind of mentality. I don't know if you guys get it. Am I getting through? Or somebody confused by what I'm saying? Because the next step is, these are the guys who are now given as a reward for this amazing ineptitude, the giving away of what could have been the best informer we ever had. And, you know, I did a show right after this happened and said that if I was Johnny Spann's family, I'd sue the CIA for reckless endangerment, reckless homicide. To send a man in to do something like that, every New York City cop knows that that's insane. But that's Tom Clancy's CIA. That's the people our Congress has no oversight over. That's the people who are at this moment doing peace talks. They're everywhere. They're rewarded. Do you understand? And it's going to be to all our detriment. To all of us. And it's going to manifest itself in what is going to happen to everybody, to our Constitution, under the regime of these amazingly inept people. One of the other things I want to tell you guys is that the most dangerous people in the world, and again, in forthcoming shows we talk about it, are inept cops with guns and badges, people who don't know how to do the job. You've got a whole agency, Central Intelligence, who don't know how to do the job. And you can see it in that instance. And now let's take where you really do the job. Informer calls me from jail. Do I go down and let... Now, this is New York. This isn't the Mujahideen. No. I never met the man. I never met him. I wouldn't take a chance on risking his information by in any way meeting him. I didn't trust the guards in prison. I didn't trust anybody. And he had phone time. He was able to call me from prison because in the Metropolitan Correction Facility, they passed the phone around. I had to risk something. And that was it. And we began talking in code. I agreed to give his wife whatever he wanted. First thing he did was set me up. He called a drug dealer, a Pakistani drug dealer named Rafiq Khan. And the informer said, Mike is a guy with the mafia, because this guy was a small mafioso type of guy. Mike wants to buy drugs. I went out to meet Rafiq Khan, just to meet him, and he showed up with a kilo of heroin at the meeting. From this meeting, I then got a Pakistani courier. And I can't, it'll take all night just to tell you this story, but my Pakistani informant, I sent him to Pakistan using Rafiq's information to connect with the sources in Pakistan. In Pakistan, DEA agent, the man living in Islamabad, was able to use the information we had to monitor and surveil and electronically record our informer from New York as he traveled these tribal areas making drug deals. And what they picked up was also terrorism. What they picked up was all kinds of information that was then given to Central Intelligence. Very valuable information. Information they don't know how to get. Now, Back to New York it comes, and the case culminates where I become, in that photo, what you saw is me posing as a Pakistani. No kidding. And me posing as a Pakistani, like I said, these guys are not that bright. So who do I meet? I meet Jimmy in the jail. Now has set up this whole trip. The mob guys, John Gotti organization, now knows that this Pakistani, I am now Omar, I forget my name, Omar Abdul, has been to Pakistan and made these connections, and he's now back. And they were able to check out that an Omar Abdul was there. That was my guy. But now I am the guy. You guys following this? So now I come back, and I meet a guy named Johnny Boy Johnson. Now, if you follow the John Gotti trials, Willie Boy Johnson is a Native American. He's a murderer. He was a murderer. He's dead now. Willie Boy Johnson was half Native American, half Sicilian, a boyhood friend of John Gotti's, and he was in jail with my informer. So he heard these drug deals. He couldn't help it. He thought they were real drug deals. So Willie Boy sets up a meet between Omar and his son Johnny Boy. Father and son hit team, by the way. Now I go out and I get permission as an undercover agent to sell the John Gotti organization heroin. It's called the reverse undercover. I'm going to sell them drugs and we're going to bust them. Out I go, I'm wired, I'm wearing everything, and I am old man, I swear to God that this is the best shit you could, yeah, and whatever, you know. And I give him a small sample of 99% pure heroin that we got from the DEA lab. And he, like I said, these guys are not the brightest guys in the world. The only people dumber than them is the Central Intelligence and the FBI. You cannot. So he so trusts me that now we cut to a conversation because the word goes back. The Gotti organization has authorized them to go through with this heroin deal with Omar. Now, mind you, this is a violation of the whole mafia code because they're not supposed to do heroin. They're not supposed to do drugs. And we know that. But we don't. What I didn't know at this point was that the FBI was working on this same organization. And so was another DEA guy who, if you heard the show, Eddie Magnuson, he was working the same organization, and none of us knew it. A situation that still continues to this day with anti-terrorism. Believe me, it still continues to this moment. We're still at September 10th, but only now we're at September 10th of what might be the end of this world. And they so trusted Omar that Willie Boy in jail with my informer Jimmy starts to talk, and they get on the subject of physical fitness. And Willie Boy tells my informant, he said, you know, when I knew I needed a fucking workout, he says, it was Christmas Eve last year. He says, hey, we got to go hit this guy. And he tells about a murder that he and Johnny did. He says, I walk out, and he says, it was in front of the Brown Derby Club. I walk out. He says, I see the guy come out. I go, pop, 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 and I had to run to the car. He says, I swear I couldn't catch my fucking breath. I knew I had a workout. It's an actual conversation. Murder in front of the Brown Derby Christmas Eve, okay. I call homicide. Homicide comes down. Turns out a man named Jay Sarno was murdered by Willie Boy and his son. How do we know? The witnesses, well, a couple of witnesses made artist drawings. It's Willie Boy, there's no doubt about it. And Willie Boy said, he popped him 3-4 times in the chest. That's exactly what. This murder didn't hit the newspaper. So it's exactly, we knew we had the homicide. Jay Sarno, by the way, was no mob guy. Let me explain to you how flimsy reality is, how flimsy your life is in this reality. Jay Sarno was a guy who insulted a woman and didn't know that she was somehow related to a mob guy. So Willie Boy killed him like a favor. This is no exaggeration, folks. This is life. He wanted to impress this mob guy, so he and Johnny went out and killed this guy Christmas Eve with his family right in front of the Brown Derby Club in Brooklyn. Dead. Murdered. That's important that this sinks in, that you understand this. It's the value of a human life. That's a question that I've spent 25 years asking myself. And now I think, wow, I feel good. I was already not feeling too good about enforcing drug laws, but I felt real good about getting killers. Now my heart was in this case, really in it. Next thing we hear is that John Gotti himself, has authorized that we go forward in this deal. So this is the plan. Now, again, this I'm used to telling cops this. I want you to follow this. The plan is that I am going to sell Johnny Boy Johnson a kilo of heroin for $100,000. And I agreed to take $50,000 out front and get the rest. Now, we're not going to give him real heroin. What we're going to give him is what's called sham heroin, fake heroin. Heroin that if you're in the business of buying heroin, you're buying dope. Most of these guys do not take the dope. They're professionals. So what they do is they test it chemically. They test it with a heat thermometer. They test it in every way possible. And sham heroin, chemically, will react like heroin in every way, except it won't get you high. So our plan was to sell them a kilo of sham heroin and follow the bag right into... We thought it was going to go right into the Bergen Hunt Club where John Getty's headquarters, and then take them all down. That would what a case. Again, being professionals, there's a certain routine you follow to protect your ass from getting shot. And that routine is called pre-surveillance. So that video that you saw, we don't have time. I have the whole video, which runs a half an hour. But you take my word for it. My men went out to the hotel right next to JFK Airport. It was the Sheraton. And that's the parking lot of the Sheraton. And they were out there an hour before I was supposed to meet them. And they arrived at a good hour before I did, which is not like a mob guy. Why? Because they were setting up a trap to kill me. Now I'm going to ask a question after this. I want to see if you guys can figure this out. They were going to kill me. Now think about this. My informer in jail, who I'd never met face to face, knew they were going to kill me. Do you understand? He knew they were setting me up to kill me. The question is going to be, why would he not tell me? What would he gain? But let's go back to what happened. Let's see if you guys know how to think like cops. Let's see if you guys know how to think unlike FBI and CIA. Now, I go out, and what you saw, if you see the whole video, you'll see me. My men picked up this trap. You know, Johnny Boy setting his guys a car, separate car, two men with guns. And DEA used this tape, by the way, for many years to train undercovers. It's called One Way In and No Way Out, because that parking lot had one way in and no way out. Now, what they had set up, and you could see it on the video, was a perfect trap. I was going to go in. They were going to make sure I had the drugs somewhere near me and give me the money, whatever they had to do, and then kill me, take it all back. Because I was Omar. To these guys, and we got this on audio tapes, to these guys, I was a raghead. Fucking difference does it make? You understand? I was some raghead who they were going to do. And that's the value of human life in this world that we're now living in. Now, as I'm driving out, my men are telling me, across the parking lot, there's men. We already videotaped through the thing. We can see they have guns. It looks like you're set up. Now I changed the plan. I said, I want to get more conversation on the murder. So this is what I want you guys to do. I said, the minute they move, you move. I don't want it to be a race for my life. and give me a chance to get this guy talking about the murder. I want to make sure he goes away for it. And what you saw, I don't know if they showed it. If you saw the whole video, which we don't have time, you'll see me talking to him with one leg out. I'm wearing bell-bottom pants, way out of style, because I carried a 9mm automatic on my ankle, and the bell-bottom pants concealed it well. And I'm trying to watch these guys across the parking lot, and I'm talking, and it looks like I have a beer can in a glass. But what I'm doing is I'm getting him to talk. And he's nervous, and I'm waiting for that trap to close. And when the trap does start to close, my men move in and stop it just in time, and the case is over. And we were able... one of the things I learned, by the way, that might interest you guys, is as an undercover agent, I found it interesting, was that when you're scared shitless, you can't fake a Pakistani accent. It's impossible. You come out like a berserk Jamaican. You know, oh, man, because I have the tape, you know. But none of it would matter, as it would turn out. So we bust them, we take the guns off them, we get the plan. We have enough to charge them with murder. We have enough to charge them with attempted homicide of a federal agent, conspiracy to traffic in drugs. We have enough to charge Willie Boy, Johnny Boy, everybody. All charges were dropped. All charges were dropped. Wondering why, huh? Well, first question is, why would the guy, he knows I'm going to be killed, why would he not say anything? Anybody figure that out? I don't think so, as a favor to the mob, because that wouldn't get him out of jail. FBI is involved in this, by the way. They are involved in this, in this whole incident. No, it's not like he was going to kill them for the FBI. He had a reason that informers have for wanting to see an agent killed while they're involved in it. Pardon? No revenge at all. When I made the buy from Rafiq, we gave his wife $17,000. You got it. He can deal his way. He's the witness. He's the guy that puts this whole thing together. I'm dead. They're going to cut a deal with him. Sammy the Bull Gravano. He can kill 21 people. He's out. The FBI come in because it's the murder of a federal agent. They'll cut any deal because I'm headlines now. You understand? I'm an FBI file story. The informer was smart enough to know that. That if I die, they need him. He can cut any deal he wants. Now, why did they drop the whole case? Again, I'm telling you that the Jay Sarno's murder was never prosecuted. I'm telling you that this whole case was never prosecuted. Why? Because what I didn't know, what nobody knew, was that Willie Boy Johnson, the guy in the cell, next to my informer, was an FBI informer. So the deal was, you can't burn Willie Boy because he's going to testify for the FBI against John Gotti. And they used that wedge, my case. Bottom line is, John Gotti killed Willie Boy. And that's real justice. I mean, this is this world that I want to educate you guys as much as possible to understand the games, the deals, what the inability to handle informers will lead to, especially under these Patriot laws. You'll see it. Now, just go on to the next one. I've got to move quickly now because I've been blabbing too long. Can you run the next one?
Informants. They have the key. So it's a quid pro quo arrangement. You save our agency. You help us convince the American people that this drug war really works, and we'll get you off whatever charges we can.
Almost enormous amounts. Interestingly enough, invariably paid in cash.
I would say that the career path for an informer, a criminal informer, is a lot more lucrative for that of an agent.
We'll see now.
Does pay.
Did you guys hear that?
Okay.
the career path for a criminal informant.
Any cooperation from the Mexican authorities on drug cases?
Not in drug cases, no.
Zero, flat out, no cooperation.
No. It's very frustrating when you know where the landing strips are just south of the border, just a few miles. When you can track the planes all the way from Colombia, see them land at ranches just on the other side of the border, see the dope being loaded under trucks and so forth, and not be able to do anything about it.
We've been told that not only do the Mexican authorities look the other way in drug cases, but they actually escort dope smugglers into the United States. Is that true?
That has happened, yes.
The reason, of course, is money. Mexican police and soldiers are paid very little in salary and are easy targets for bribes. That is exactly what this man did, former DEA agent Mike Levine. He bribed the grandson of a former president of Mexico in an elaborate sting operation. Levine promised the man, a Mexican colonel, $1 million if he would allow a plane full of cocaine to land in Mexico. The sting was videotaped by the DEA and chronicled in Levine's book, Deep Cover.
He came up to the States in his Mexican colonel uniform to show me that I was dealing with the bona fide Mexican government and that I could count on Mexican military protection for my drug plane. The military was going to come in and close off this whole road, cut down trees so that our plane can land.
Okay, you can cut it there.
Guard our drug plane.
All right, quick, if those of you who haven't read the book Deep Cover, what happened was, and what they wouldn't say on the air, was Edwin Meese, the Attorney General of the United States, blew the cover of that case. Now, this book was a New York Times bestseller. I said in the book, the Attorney General of the United States blew the cover of a case. Why? There were all kinds of reasons. Central Intelligence, again, was behind every goddamn door. The life of undercover agents meant nothing to these other interests, which permeate everything around 911. These other interests were more important. And very stupidly, again, the Central Intelligence, as inept as they are, were backing informers who were using the CIA like condoms to do it to America. The Condom Intelligence Agency is what they're... Guys, I'm a professional, and they're not. And that's the difference. They're just not. And that's what's frightening now about what's about to happen to us. But here's a case again. Human intelligence, covert ops. Human intelligence. How did this case begin? It began with a jailhouse informer. A guy who wanted to cut a deal, and he did. And this informer brought an undercover team right to the top of the drug world in the Bolivian jungles, brought us into Panama, where we met the people running both the Medellin cartel and the Bolivian cartel's money laundering. Only they were then working for our friend then, Manuel Noriega. Brought us right to the top. That Mexican colonel was a grandson of the president of Mexico. Also at that table was the bodyguard for the president of Mexico. We were at the top of that government. That whole case was killed. Because in every place we went, these people were Central Intelligence assets. How much more damage can they do to this country? Again, why am I frightened about what's about to happen now? That they've been rewarded with more power, more money than they ever had. I'll leave that to you. Let's move on to the next one.
The Mexican officialdom, nothing is.
As a result of Levine's case, the Mexican colonel was convicted of conspiracy to distribute narcotics and is now serving 24 years in an American prison. Carlos Salinas, the current Mexican president, hotly denies there is official corruption in his country and points to recent drug
seizures. These people were all working right out of his office.
Mexico's own war on drugs. But many believe that this is simply a smokescreen, a few seizures for public relations effect. And there is no doubt that Mexico is very sensitive to bad PR on its handling of drugs. When NBC ran a TV movie about Kiki Camarena, the American DEA agent who was murdered by Mexican police, the Salinas government actually accused Camarena of being a drug smuggler himself.
How did you feel when you read the Mexican government accuse Kiki Camarena of selling drugs?
I don't know who I hated worse, the Mexican government or the American apologists for Mexico, the Americans who, no matter what they do, stand up and say, oh yes, they're improving this year.
The government of Mexico would not provide a spokesman to talk about drugs with Inside Edition. Likewise, Attorney General Richard Thornburgh and Secretary of State James Baker would not answer any questions. So the question remains, why doesn't the United States come down harder on Mexico in the war on drugs? The answer, according to highly placed U.S. government officials, is twofold. First, the U.S. is afraid Mexico will stop paying its huge debts to American banks if drug pressure is increased. And secondly, the State Department fears Mexico will no longer cooperate in the struggle against communism in Latin America.
That's right.
The United States
CIA.
To be much more worried about Mexico's economy collapsing or its failure to pay its debt than they are about drugs coming across the border.
William Von Raab should know. Under President Reagan, he was in charge of stopping drugs from coming into the United States.
There was more disturbing news in the fall of 1993.
Just a couple of postscript. That was the truth. How many of you remember seeing this anywhere in the media? Again, the control of media is fantastic, and that's why anything can be done and will be done, and you'll see when I finish this off, and you can count on media not telling you. You can count on them not telling you, and I'll show you a specific example, a terrible example, that's going to affect everything that we're about to live through. What's his name? Inside Edition, Bill, whatever his name, he challenged at the end of the show. He said, we're not letting this go. We're going to get answers. Our government refused to answer, which is what they always do. Instead, they go out and manipulate Geraldo, Larry King Live, everybody, the New York Times, the Washington Post, to tell you, well, Mexico's really cooperating, let's give them more money, let's give them... The fact of the matter is, the truth that we knew in DEA was that the people who slowly tortured Kiki Camarena to death, who drove a screwdriver into his head, who drove hot rods all the way up his rectum, with a doctor keeping him alive, testimony in court in California said that these people believed they were working for Central Intelligence. This is testimony in a U.S. court. And, well, they did. They believed that they were. They have a record. Oddly enough, how a doctor kept him alive. You know how we know that? Central Intelligence. Nobody ever, we don't know who he is. Allegedly. Now, it's a great question. Doctor, did the doctor go to prison? A week after we found Kiki's body, Central Intelligence mysteriously, and to this day, I don't know how they did it, came up with tape recordings of his tortured death. You just can't jump to the conclusion and say they did it, because basically what happens is they have their college boys, the fraternity boys that don't know how to handle informers. And these informers feel like they can do anything once they're working for Central Intelligence, and they do. And they get away with it. And it's about to get much worse, and all I can do is, yes, sir. Well, again, you're not dealing with the brightest bulb in the universe, these people. And what I found is that wherever they can get publicity, which gave them tremendous publicity, you know, what happens is the CIA helped DEA find the truth, what happened. The wonderful CIA, the wonderful Central Intelligence, these mysterious Tom Clancy guys with eyes everywhere, were able to come up. Do you understand how the PR works? And well, you know, I mean, just the fact that when we hit the top of the drug world in this thing called Operation Trifecta, and in one tape-recorded conversation with one of my bosses, when he told me the CIA is in this in four countries, I knew we were in trouble. And sure enough, the case was destroyed. And myself, if you guys who read the book, I was in Panama when this happened, and I didn't believe myself and my undercover partner were going to get out of Panama alive. And both of us believed that Central Intelligence wanted us dead. I never thought, you know, part of what I try to do with the show is get frontline people to come on and give you evidence that I know would stand up in court. That's why I urge you to go on the website, and you'll see a paper I did called I Volunteer to Kidnap Ollie North. And what you'll see in that paper is evidence that was shown to Congress. You know, Ollie sues every damn body. Now, I'm telling you, as a court-qualified expert witness, I value what I say. I have to, because I make a living. I don't make a living doing this. I make a living going into court and testifying as an expert against some of these cases. So I cannot risk telling you bullshit, because I'm going to tell you something. Everything I do comes back to me when I'm on the witness stand in court trying to qualify as an expert. Not a media-anointed expert. An expert that has to face defense attorneys who want to just tear my guts out. So when everything I say, everything I put on the show, everything I put on the website, it comes from frontline people who are first-hand witnesses. So I can't conjecture. I can tell you what happened, what I know happened. And what happened was Edwin Meese, the Attorney General of the United States, blew this case, blew the cover. How much more do you need? You have a federal agent who the DEA, they called me one of their best in the New York Times. You can't take that back. And I'm saying Edwin Meese betrayed all of us. But that's just the beginning. And the only thing this serves as right now is to show you the mindset that you don't know about. A mindset that is prevalent now. A reward. The reward is given for those who keep their fucking mouths shut and live up. When you raise your hand, when you go to work as a federal agent, a covert agent, a CIA agent, you take two oaths. One oath is to defend the Constitution and you guys. The other oath is to defend the secrecy of this bureaucracy. And the first lesson you learn when you get out is one directly contradicts the other. Because the first thing you're sent out to do is to violate that Constitution. The second lesson you learn is that those few of us who come forward and say, this is wrong, we pay. We pay big time. When you had Colleen Rowley, one FBI agent out of 25,000, come out and say that the joke in the FBI was that FBI headquarters were moles for bin Laden, the joke is on us. Because what happens, how this manifests itself now, is they have to cover that up by proving to you with bullshit cases like Jose the Terrorist, that which, by the way, was rubber stamped by the New York Times as a terrorist plot thwarted. The only place you heard people from the FBI come on and say it's a lie, it's a publicity, was on my show. Last week, if you heard, I had Hugo Rodriguez, 25-year FBI agent and defense attorney, come on and say it's an absolute lie. But the New York Times told you it's a victory for the FBI. Well, we should have had the Patriot Laws 20 years ago. Do you understand what the struggle that's going on? I'm trying so hard to just make you guys see this. Anyway, yeah, go ahead, buddy. Yeah, go ahead.